So thank you for joining us. We're speaking after the panel that was focused on Iran and the intervention of Iran in Syria, the Syrian arena after the Russian intervention, and of course the security concerns of Israel and other states. Joining us, Anna Borshevskaya, an expert on Russia's foreign policy in the Middle East, researcher at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, Washington, D.C. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, based on what you heard and said in the panel, and your assessment as a researcher about the Russian interest in the Middle East, what is the main reason for arming Assad's military with the S-300 a few months ago? An anti-aircraft system, as you know, I mean, Israel is very concerned about this issue, and this is obviously against the interest of Israel, unlike previous understandings in this regard. What made the Russians change their mind?
Right. So this incident, you know, first and foremost, let me just say this incident, as I said on the panel, it exposed the Russians as incompetent. It was embarrassing. Assad shut down a Russian plane. Their own ally shut down their plane, you know, planes that they've been flying for about the 1980s. What did they do? Rather than taking responsibility, they blamed Israel. And we're still, as I said in the panel, we're still in the middle of this incident. They brought the S-300 as ostensibly as a defensive response. The Russians brought the S-400 to Syria also for similar reasons in the past. If you recall, it was after the Russians were attacked, Russian soldiers stationed there. But the fact of the matter is, the S-300, it fits within the broader Russian what's called A2AD network, anti-aerial access denial. And I think that's important. Now, that said, look, the S-300, it's not the newest model. Based on what we know from open sources, the S-300 version variant that was brought to Syria is also not the most advanced one, because the S-300 is a family of different types of systems. It gets very technical and complicated. But the fact of the matter is, what they did is they used this very embarrassing episode to assert dominance. The bringing of the S-300 is an assertion of dominance, and it fits overall within the A2AD network. The idea with the A2AD bubble that the Russians are trying to create is to limit Western ability to maneuver. They have not achieved this completely, because a complete bubble means that nobody else can operate. That's not the case. The United States has been able to operate, for example, but the fact of the matter is it's been made more difficult. So it's a partial bubble, so to speak, and the S-300 fits within that that broader strategy of A2AD, anti-aerial access denial.
So how good or bad are the Israeli-Russian relations regarding the Syrian arena, which we've just discussed in the panel, beyond the military coordination about attacks, as we know? Is there a core of agreement between the two about what should be done against or regarding the Iranian presence and entrenchment in Syria?
Well, Israel is in a very difficult situation because Russia is on their doorstep. And the United States, for years, has been signaling retreat from the Middle East. This started under President Obama. Russia wants to have good relations with Israel. And the deconfliction mechanisms were always very good. There is a lot of communications between Moscow and Israel on deconfliction. But the fact of the matter is, Russia wants everyone subordinate to it. Even when I talk to Israeli analysts and officials, there's a sense that, well, Russia is a great power on our doorstep. It's not an equal relationship. It's more about realpolitik, whereas the relationship between Israel and the United States is based on very deep values. It's a very deep and enduring friendship. That's not the case between Russia and Israel. With regard to Iran, though, I think we should have no illusions. Russia has, frankly, I think neither ability nor desire to restrain Iran in Syria and elsewhere. What it wants to do is to play peacemaker. to tell everybody that, that Russia can be the mediator, and instead just play everybody off of each other and sort of come out on top as the ultimate arbiter. And that's always been historically the Kremlin playbook when it came to Russia's near abroad, when it came to minorities. It's playing everybody off against the other. I just think it's wishful thinking that Russia can genuinely restrain Iran.
You think they don't have any real intent to restrain the Iranians, even if this may cost them losing stability in Syria?
I think they want to show a veneer. For example, which is different from genuine restraint. My colleague Philip Smythe had actually talked about this in the panel as well. Yeah, there was a temporary pullback, right? But it wasn't real. Some people can switch uniforms, frankly. You can say, well, there's no Hezbollah. They've taken off their uniforms. So I wouldn't trust the Russians to say that there could be some short-term tactical maneuvering to create an appearance of doing something. That's not real. That's not genuine.
Okay. I would like to take the opportunity and ask you about another very interesting aspect of your expertise, which is looking closely at the Russian media in Arabic. Mm-hmm. What is the most interesting finding you found in this regard?
Yeah, well, my colleague Catherine Cleveland and I did the study on Russia's Arabic propaganda. I think one of the most interesting things that we found is the emphasis on Arabic-speaking youth in Russian propaganda outreach. And that tells you something about long-term thinking, that even if maybe right now all the efforts that Russia is putting into this, and Russia is putting a lot of effort into it, I just want to underscore that, even if they're not paying off now, because of the emphasis on the youth on social media, where increasingly more and more people are turning to for news, suggests that these efforts could especially pay off in the long term. I think that's the most significant finding. I would also say very briefly, I think most people don't know this. When we think about Russian propaganda, we usually think of it in terms of its relationship with the West, right? And it's certainly a topic that's been covered a lot in the West. But when you look at RT, the flagship Russian propaganda,
Russia Today,
exactly, formerly Russia Today, after it came out in English, the second language that it came out in was Arabic, followed by Spanish. And only then did other languages come out, which shows you the direction of Russian thinking very early on. This was in mid-2000s.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.